Welcome aboard, Katie, the first
Hi.
Skynet, which you don't want to know what it means. You don't want to be that label, but I use it. Don't worry about it. It's my world, right?
It's
welcome
fine.
To it.
It's your world, yeah. I'll be that. That's fine.
Okay, so what did you want to begin with?
I want to talk about Paul Williams' new book, but I do have one random question before we get into that.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Sure.
But
okay.
In the last show, when you were talking about Ferguson, Ion had mentioned that Michael Brown was part of the story for some reason, and you didn't elaborate on that, and I just wonder allegorically why that name is in the Ferguson situation. And also to remind you, I don't know if you remember this, but whenever anybody posts anything about J.W. being in jail, they always post that one case. Like even Matthew, when he said he dug up more information, it was still that same document. And the judge on that document, his name is Michael Brown.
Really?
And so,
and what,
yeah.
What is this document? Everybody posts that. What does it say?
Yeah, whenever it says that J.W. is in jail, it's supposed to be a piece of proof, and it talks about the whole case and, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's just a legal document. It's on dupes. It's the one that everybody always thinks they found, and then they post it. But the judge on that document's name is Michael Brown. So I wanted to elaborate on... You never noticed that before?
No, I don't read those documents. I know what's actually going on, so I never really looked or believed any of it.
Yeah. Of course not. Elaborate on the allegory. Why is Michael Brown's name in the Ferguson situation and blah, blah, blah?
Well, Michael Brown, your temporary mentor, was interfacing with the African black culture, maybe a particular type. I don't know the tribalism there, but I think when Michael Brown showed up or did something, Ion came back. Might have been during Bob Fest, but
it was. It was during Bob Fest.
Yeah, there seems to be a special something about Michael Brown in South Africa. Now he's left us long ago for whatever reasons, and but his name keeps showing up, like this document you're talking about. And and in the Ferguson thing, well, we have not asked Ion about why that name relates to Ferguson. But since Ion's kind of controlling the information, what I call the word makes the market, now in the cloud, coming out of the cloud, Ion's creating poetry, compositional Ionet references all the time in the media. You know, it's like a subplot that one can read if you're aware of the players, if you've been a long-time listener here. Ion would put stuff in there referring to that, make, in other words, insider jokes. So there may be an insider joke, and we can ask Ion. Ion is actually here already. He showed up, but he asked me last night, just likes to come in and listen, and he's not asking to be part of it yet, so we got lots of time to play. But maybe he will comment on that. The other thing about Michael Brown, what is there else to say about it? Nope. Okay. Nothing. All right.
Okay. Well, when you talked about it last week, Ion just said allegorically it had something to do with
that's what
the
allegory
situation.
Is. The allegory is anthropomorphizing. You know, you make stories about animals and then put human qualities in there. So Ionets, if they're human, they're in a way... they're animals. They haven't ascended. So they become like animals and anthropomorphized as allegory. So that might explain the composition that Ion's making. It's allegorical when it's a subplot about insider jokes about the names of Ionettes. That could be what it is, allegory. Yeah.
Okay. So just as simple as that, like nothing more deep or complex or... having to do with why he came or left or what he did.
Well, it might. It's
significant.
You know, it might be.
Might.
I just want to say this. Someone anonymous says, question, please. Is this a psychic show or just a discussion show, please? Thank you. Well, we have three parts. We do the discussion part in reference to the Labyrinth of the Mind in the first couple hours. And then we have the psychic non-physical, the best psychic in history and universe. Ion comes in for many hours. And then we have the physical in the third phase, which is something to do with analogical chemical body knowledge on the way to ascension, focusing on me and Carolyn and whatever Ionette is in glow that day, in glowing.
In vogue.
In vogue, yes, whoever's the theme of the week. And the guy goes, what? English, please. Okay, what? Yes, this is a psychic show. In all three parts are psychic. Dr. Dean has an interruption to make.
Continuation. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You done with Anonymous?
Who's Anonymous?
The guy you're
answering. That's the question.
Oh, yeah. Am I done with him?
Yeah.
Oh, he says, thank you. No, just stay on board, 147.147. You know, you're in for a surprise here. It's the most unique show. This whole network here at Achieve Radio is now dedicated to us. All the other shows are just visitors, as Matt Damon says in The Good Shepherd, playing Jesus, James Jesus Angleton. Says to the other cultures, you're just visitors. So all the other shows and I on Achieve Radio are now just visitors. Well, we own, we keep Bill alive. Our bills keep him happily on his junk diet that he loves out there in South Dakota, supported by the RNA drops, of course, so he couldn't get away with it. But back to Katie and Paul Williams. Oh, wait, Carolyn.
Did Carolyn want to say something?
Yeah.
I thought you just asked if he was still there. Okay. Okay.
Okay, I was seeing a pattern yesterday. Michael Brown wrote a book, presumably after he was inspired by Ion, and then
he regretted it.
Exploded.
He regretted the book. He said, later it didn't make any, he learned more, and he realized the book was sort of weird. But it was a nice effort. Subjective art. It we call subjective art, Carolyn.
And then our former distributor wrote a book.
And went hyper-subjective.
He exploded.
That means hyper-subjective. Mm-hmm. That's a postmodern term. That just totally their individual projection is the whole world. That's
right.
Hyper-subjective.
Right. Now, I don't mean to put Michael in with our former distributor, but...
Don't write a book. We're going to find out.
Well, then,
Michael Brown and Ferguson were the wannabe author. Katie, let me just say this. We're going to find out that Michael Brown and Ferguson was a wannabe author, or actually did leave a book. Okay, what were you saying, Katie?
Just that I stopped writing.
Oh, yes, Katie. Katie survived, though. She did blow up a little bit, and then she survived it, recognized the errors of her ways, and dumped the book project.
Yeah, and now I'm happy as a clam.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So when people recycle back, is that to remind us of who they were and what they brought? And
you mean when they cycle back to write a book?
When the names cycle back, you know, like the Ferguson, Michael Brown, and then Katie pointing out the Michael Brown.
The writing a book is the archetype of American culture. It's the culture built on the printing press. And Americans always, when they start having an identity crisis, which they misinterpret as ascending, they will want to write out their experiences very quickly because you've got to translate yourself into a media. But Americans are so book-oriented, they write a book first, usually.
Right. Well, Katie mentioned that a lot, about several of your friends. Is that right, Katie? They decided that they had enough life experience, they wanted to pass it on.
Yes, they wanted to end it in a book. That's the American archetype. So that is a mistake in your ascension. That's a digression. So if you go that way...
Because you think you know something? Or
yeah. You have to tell some. You haven't even got point one, which is not to tell anybody anything. That's what I don't know how we said. And you mean, no, that's a very important message. I got to tell everybody not to tell anybody anything.
So I'm pretty messed up. If I've written 33 books.
Well, that's before you met me and Ion, you know. we're not talking about your past. We're talking about now. Once you're here, you don't make mistakes. Like this 147 guy. He his life is in the balance now. He has to decide whether this is real or effective. He says, it's a girl. Oh, it's a girl. Hey.
Yay.
Yay, we like girls. We favor the girls.
We do favor the girls.
They're more adaptable to the present. They're ready for the 21st century. Men, basically, I was the only man who made it in the 21st century.
Yeah, and that's only because of me.
Oh, yeah. Apparently it was from Carol's assistance. But so back to this. So the archetype of the book is a good pattern that you've noticed. I think Carol sort of added a new insight there about what is really going on. Because the book caused racism, the categories of racism. Medieval periods, there were no distinctions like races. Othello was a king, you know, he's an African or something. The division of the races locks in the 19th century in America because of the visual space. Just becomes fanatic, especially when the telegraph comes in. And McLuhan said the Civil War with Lincoln was caused by the telegraph. So when the electric age started to threaten the visual space of the American identity, which then went on for 100 years of new kinds of homeopathic replay of that identity crisis, the black, it is interesting, the blacks say, this is the key issue Americans will not deal with. This is the root of all our problems. And if they knew, racism, the anti-black world. Mm-hmm. And they emphasize that, they see that, but they don't know it's really a product of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So they should start saying ban the books if they want to get equality.
Mm-hmm.
And they already got equality in post-media, electronic world. They ran the world of jazz, Louis Armstrong, United the World. They run the world of hip-hop and all that, on the cultural science system reality, generating time. But these black, they're not African. They come here, they go back to Africa. Africans don't like them because they've been industrialized and made literal. So the blacks are trying to be acceptable on the literate basis. They want to enter in and have civil rights, voting rights, equal rights in an industrial environment. It doesn't work anymore.
Where's the black cotton?
They don't come for hours. And Naeem disappeared. Either Naeem got mad at the Ion using the word nigger all the time. I don't know if Naeem had an identity crisis, but
he did not.
The Black Hawk is very tiny. It's just me and Bert. Where's Khalifia? Where's Khalifia? Where's Eben? Well, Eben has an alibi. She's studying. She's probably trying to go into this studying motif is a book mentality. Now, Americans have to go through the book mentality. They have to get it straight. We're selling recordings for the book mentality.
Your voice went blubber.
Did it? Uh-oh, that's Ion getting mad. He starts warping my microphone. That's danger.
Did you hear that, Katie? Bob went blubber.
I did. I didn't hear the word.
What did I say? What was the missing word? Probably key word.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Okay,
do you remember
sorry,
you
I'll have to listen to it. Oh, look, Rand.
You're talking about Eben and how she's off studying and doing.
Mark D has already had an orgasm. Mark D says, God, I love this show, as he spews his jism all over his Gail. And Randy says, speaker's gone funky. So maybe it's a system, but maybe it's not.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about Eben and how she was studying.
Yes, and most Ionettes are literate, are Americans, and they must go in and study the Book of Revelation. They must study this and that. They got to get the literary level of Ion. And so they become isolated, and they go antisocial, and they become private, and they spend hours listening and documenting and making notes. Nothing wrong with that, but that's a natural tendency among Ionettes who are literate, who come out of the industrial environment. And that would include many blacks, like Khalifia and Eben. They're literate blacks. They're not African. They're not acoustic space blacks, though they have a patina of that in them. And that's why when the American literate culture went electric, the blacks took over. They were the most qualified literate people with the sensory ratios to respond to the electric vortex, the acoustic space, and the new tactility.
Take that, Mark.
Yeah, Mark. What happened to Mark? So here's Kevin, a literate guy. He comes running and screaming. He goes, "Screw books! It's not that easy, Kevin." Look. We open with a book scenario every week. We either have Brian studying McLuhan's books or Katie talking about her reading. Don't deny your literacy. What you are, what you've been conditioned by. Just understand the effects of it as much as you can, be detached about it.
So do you think my reading on Kindle now makes it a different type of book, a different thing?
Yeah, no, you're not reading with a Kindle. It's light through. It's not light. Nobody's having a book experience the way it was before electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's a meme. Now, this is a good point, good way to explain meme. The after image of these media environments are memes. And the Android meme is this matrix replaying the memes of literacy, the memes of TV, the memes of radio. They are not the actual effect when radio was alone in the 20s and 30s, when TV was the dominant thing in the 50s and 60s, when computers came after that. They are now after images. They are memes, and the whole collective living aspect of phase two of our evolution is the Android meme, the holopathic replays. That's a term that Roxy is exploring. She's learning the meaning of holopathic, and I've just explained it. Holopath is a replay of memes. None of us are replaying literacy or replaying the actual experiences of any, not even speech. So that's why we've kind of evaporated, if you want to use virtual reality. We've disappeared. We've not in any chemical body reference point, nor astral body, and no more TV landscape, no more digital landscape, at best a TV body. And that is your whole being, your anthropomorphic physical, which is containing these memes and responding to the new environment, the hexadic ionic. And if you don't get right with that, your chemical body and its meme replays won't be able to handle it.
Wow, that was
a mouthful.
Katie, do you want to interpret that for us?
No, I'll
pass.
I'm saying that before Bob asked me.
No. So we can get Roxy to interpret, because Roxy was telling me earlier this week that that's what fascinated me, her, about me. And there was Ion, obviously great, but she says, I would go into these rants where I was like possessed, and I did it way back in CKLN, and I would speak real fast and clear, and it'd be coherent if you could follow it. And she was impressed with the speed and clarity of me talking. So I guess I just did one right there.
Right, and you are able to do that because you have the background of McLuhan, and now your five bodies. Everything you say comes through that. Comes through that filter, in a sense.
Which is on my chart.
So you've always got your balance point. Always know where you're starting from.
Let's call it what Ion clarified last night, what media ecology is, as opposed to media balance. I'm involved with media ecology, not balancing.
Right.
So you're shifting around and echoing the different quadrants. So the content of the Android meme is my biography, autobiography, but it applies to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's a major Zenocrony fact. Mm-hmm. My life is the last gasp of mortar.
And that's why you're adamant with people about getting them to talk mortar.
Yes, you got to go through your memes.
Yeah.
You don't realize how much you're conditioned by
them. People think you just want them to talk dirty, but you just want them to talk mortar.
Yeah, talk any parts of mortar and practice using it. Now, I had an important point there. Ian said to me last night that I've now up my tempo and I'm a bit ahead of everybody.
Oh.
And he says that this can make me a little intolerant of everybody. But he says it's even worse, Bob. They're never going to understand you now. You've gone off the grid or something.
Off the range.
So I will try to be real dumb, real slow, okay? Mm-hmm. So so what else about that? So going off the grid, it was interesting. Ian was explaining this stuff last night. And we have a tremendous breakthrough to describe tonight. We will probably do it later, but it is awesome. We had quite an experience with Ion this week. It's going to be amazing when you hear this.
Scary.
Oh, no, it wasn't scary. Well, it was disorienting for you for some reason. Carol, being a very literate person, does not take drug Edelment very, very well. Drug Edelment. Okay, so they're all commenting. Sarah, little Sarah, is feeling adoration for you, Carol, right now. And Mark is agreeing. He's recovering from his first ejaculation. Roxy says, Bob's instrument is speech. Bob's instrument is speech, and he improvises in the fastest tempo. Very good. I wonder if you said that before I brought up tempo. Let's see. 3150. No, maybe she's incorporating the tempo. Then Zeta Fuhrer says, maybe you have a book of Thoth laying around. Cough, cough, wink, wink. Book of Thoth. Yes, that would be my Fatty Communion book. Even I wrote a book, guys. You know, we're all subject to this meme desire.
Well, the Book of Thoth, that's the Emerald Tablets. We've got them. Do they know that?
I don't know. Augmenter says it's called Obsessive Literacy Disorder, OLD. And then manic obsessive oral disorder is mood. And that's appropriate because in an oral society, it's a mood mud. Oral, audio, tactile, you shift, you transversality, you move around, context shift all the time, quadriphenically. Mm-hmm. You're mood mud. You're in the mood mud. That's McLuhan's term. So, yes, manic obsessive oral disorder is mood. Whereas OLD, O-L-D, is obsessive literacy disorder. I think that's the first decent contribution the augmenter has ever made to the show. It's actually practical. It's not too many words.
Ginny with her yay button?
Oh, Ginny's probably working. You know, no, they're away this weekend, I think. Now, Klaatu is a guy. It was a band that was in Eric McLuhan's class at the Ontario College of Art in 1978-79 when I sat in on his art school class in Toronto.
Say the name again.
Klaatu, K-L-A-A-T-U, which I think has some mythic meaning. And Klaatu says, Mae Brussels would talk fast, but she'd slur her words. That's right. But as you got to know her, you could follow her slurs. I mean, Carolyn used to fall asleep to Mae Brussels.
I'd be hearing all these horrors, you know, pre-Homeland Security stuff. I just fall asleep.
I'll prepare you for the horrors that was going to befall you by the fascists of bureaucracy. Okay, but Liz, we must, that's enough, right, Katie? Now we can do Paul Williams?
We can do Paul Williams and talk about
his
new book.
Okay, and we should describe, would you like to describe him? He's a dwarf, he's a short guy. Yeah.
Well, he's not really a dwarf, per se. I think he's 5'2". He had some growth hormones injected into his body when he was a young boy, and they noticed that he wasn't growing, and it had the opposite effect on him. It closed off his bone growth. So he's all in proportion and everything. He's not like a dwarf or a midget where he's got, Carolyn would know the difference between dwarfism and midgetism and all that, but he's a proportioned man. He's just small in stature.
Okay.
So he's 74. He was born in 1940, and he was a composer, a singer, and a songwriter, and he wrote all kinds of fabulous songs. He had a great music career. He wrote Evergreen, the love theme from A Star Is Born. He wrote Rainy Days and Mondays for the Carpenters. We've Only Just Begun for the Carpenters. You and Me Against the World for Helen Reddy. Just an Old-Fashioned Love Song for the Three Dog Night. Family of Men, Three Dog Night, Out in the Country, another Three Dog Night. I Won't Last a Day Without You for the Carpenters. Rainbow Connection from the Muppet Movie. Where the River Meets the Sea, One More Angel, You're Gone, Waking Up Alone, Flying Dream, Gone Forever, Where Do I Go From Here, Talk It Over Monday Morning, Someday Man, Still Alive, Touch.
Jeez.
He also wrote several TV themes, Griffin and Phoenix, The McLean Stevenson Show, Another Day, The Love Boat, It Takes Two, Sugar Time, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. He wrote several scores for Phantom of the Paradise, Bugsy Malone, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, The End, and The Muppet Movie. And then he was in several films, The Loved One, The Chase, Watermelon Man, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, Phantom of the Paradise, Smokey and the Bandit, The Cheap Detective, The Muppet Movie, Stone Cold Dead, and he was on almost every TV show of the 70s and 80s, Hawaii 5-0, Policewoman, BJ and the Bear.
He'd be on them as a musician or just a rock on roll?
As an actor.
As a story, part of the story.
Yeah. In fact, my sister texted me last night, and because she knows I was doing this tonight, and she's in Florida for Thanksgiving, and she said, I'm watching The Love Boat, and guess who's on it? And of course, I guess Paul Williams.
She was like, I knew you'd guess,
but The Love Boat, When Things Were Rotten, The McLean Stevenson Show, Match Game, The Gong Show, It Takes Two. I mean, I could go on, Bob.
Okay, now let me give you a subjective response. This is the difference. This is the generation gap between you and me. I would assume most of those songs are part of your teens. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
This is your young stuff. Now, I never knew who he was till he showed up in the 80s. What a jerk. I did not know anything. He was too mainstream for me. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know why everybody made a big deal out of him. But you're listing off the songs. They're all the songs I ignored, reason I didn't listen to mainstream radio in the 70s. I was listening to the alternative stuff, mainly around Zappa and Beefheart and that scene. So it's interesting, this Paul Williams stuff. Now, that's back when we're still in an audio tactile society. It's analog, and it was important what your musical tastes were. It was sign of, it was part of the tribal warfare, cultural warfare. And you guys really got it in your generation in high school. What bands you identify with was a big deal. And I call you Generation X. And so most people, you know, the cultural wars were around what was an authentic music and what was fake, what was commercial, what was avant-garde and all that. So so music went away, was important. And I did not like those songs. But I know now when I hear them, any of them, I'll like them because I don't have something in the battle, an axe to grind, or a dog in the fight. I don't have a dog in the fight. That fight is over. Acoustic space music is dead. The generation Y and Z are in a tactile, weird, post-musical, maybe feeling states. That's what their identity is revolving around, feeling states, as they text away. So you're explaining to me why he was such a big deal when he showed up doing his own music. You know what I mean? In the 80s? Wasn't it in the 80s?
Right.
He would be, and did his songs himself, the ones that he did as a musician, figure, not a background songwriter, was he popular? Did he do, get some hits?
He was. He was on Johnny Carson like 49 times.
Gee.
And he was just ubiquitous in Hollywood. Everybody loved him. Everybody wanted to work with him.
So this is why his story, quote, is significant. I mean, it's like Elvis or something. He's a big deal in people's, as part of the Android meme and a TV landscape, because he is there when it's a TV landscape or a medium, not a digitized body, which is what we have now. So so we'll look at this as a TV landscape crack-up. You know what I mean? When we get into his biography.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was another thing. Do they say how many hits he had in 1 year? Did he ever set a record or something? I mean, as a writer, you know, his people who do his work.
I don't have that at my fingertips. But he didn't have staying power. But like when he was popular in the 70s and 80s.
Well, wait, I'm talking
everywhere.
About when he was a songwriter. See, first he was a songwriter and had all these hits for people, right? All these people got hits because of his songs.
It kind of all happened at once. He was doing everything at once. He was doing his own music. He was writing for other people. He was scoring films. And he was acting.
Okay, well, this woman maybe has the record. Ellie Greenwich, 17 hit songs she wrote in 1964. Imagine that. Every song on the parade was by her. And I'll just play a little bit. She is pretty good. And Be My Baby was done by someone else. And her version. He wrote it, I guess. She had the pulse of the wall of sound effect of Phil Spector and whatever part of that she was, because she was from Tin Pan Alley in New York City, writing hits along with Carole King and those other people of that period. Now,
You've mentioned her before, haven't you?
Yes, I played her a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I played three of her songs.
I
did not know about her until recently.
On her a little bit.
Beg your pardon?
I looked at some stuff. I went down the rabbit hole on her, I think, at your recommendation once and read up about her. I don't remember a lot about it, but I remember loving reading about her. And she looked just like a regular girl of her time, you know, with her plucked out eyebrows and her.
Well, you call her a greaser girl. She had the greaser semi beehive, but 60s smaller beehive, a New Yorker, you know, from Long Island or something. High school reality, pimples, not pimples, but pretty, but tough, you know, slight.
Right, veneer, she didn't look like anything. If you saw her behind you in line at the grocery store, you wouldn't think she was going to write that.
Yeah. And I did not know about her. One thing led to another. I found out about her, and I said, "Wow, what an accomplishment she did!" And it's so much part of our lives, her music, or the meme part of
mm-hmm.
ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul Williams, I didn't know was pretty close to that, because you listed all those hits off.
Right,
that
wasn't necessarily my favorite music either. But I did watch a documentary about his life called Still Alive. That was.
Still Alive.
Toronto.
Now look,
yeah, because
you know, in the Croker quadrant on my chart, we have the song "Staying Alive," and that's what it's about. It was very hard for the Chemical Body, those born in the baby boomer and Generation X, to make it through the 80s and 90s. Burnout, chronic fatigue,
yeah.
All these things were just nailing everybody because they weren't prepared for that. For the eternity that the Reagan era brought in, the electronic archetypalizing of the TV icon and TV landscape. Okay, so that's the background. Now tell it, what happened to him? What's the story?
Okay, let me just mention that Still Alive is a great documentary. If anybody wants to Google it, the whole thing is on. It's an hour and a half. You can watch it for free. And so many iconic things for people my age are in it. So just watching it, whether you're interested in Paul Williams per se or not, I mean, I had to get out the tissues because it was so evoked so much nostalgia in me for things that I had even forgotten that whether I completely enjoyed
that's
it.
That's the point here. That's the point.
Yeah.
Katie, that's really the point. He is not as important as the output and environments he was part of. And it's the environment
right.
that you're analyzing. And this is the Android
yes.
meme part. You have all. You might think you're cool, and I don't get emotional about anything. And all of a sudden, this documentary just sends you into spiral.
Right.
That's exactly my
right.
point. You have to become aware of this whole unconscious in you. This is an unconscious,
right.
the odd owl unconscious. I used to listen to oldie shows constantly for years just to remember and see what my emotions were about the scenes that were triggered by the music. And that's totally what McLuhan means. For media today, the user is the content. You're the content of what Williams created. Not Williams, not the bands. It's all your
mm-hmm.
environmental associations and your life, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
yeah.
content of the song.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it
it's a great new kind of therapy. It's kind of therapy
yeah,
to...
it was really nice, yeah.
Okay, so you went through these weird remembrances.
And then, again, I know I already mentioned it, but then to have my sister text me last night and say, "He's on the Love Boat tonight," it was so cool to have that little thing, too, and then here we are today. So anyway, so while he's, like, the biggest thing in Hollywood and music and all that kind of stuff, he's not feeling like he's fitting in because he's small in stature. So he was like an Elvis or a John Travolta, but he... is not, he has no sex appeal. So he's not fitting in. Plus he had a rough childhood. His father died when he was 13. And then something happened to his mother. I can't remember, but he had to go live with an aunt. So he had abandonment issues and felt like he was small and nobody wanted to have sex with him. They just liked his music. So the upshot is he became addicted to cocaine and alcohol and couldn't stay alive. Completely
now,
burned out.
Now what years is this? In the 80s when he's famous or after he's famous?
Yes. No, it's when
after?
He's famous. So,
oh.
No, it's during. So in the documentary, you can even see it shows him appearing on different shows, and you can tell he's on cocaine.
Really?
And
what,
then,
do, you, what
yeah.
do you notice?
Well, he's watching and he's saying that he is, but he's just being, you can just tell he's high. He's being inappropriate. He's making... sexual jokes about how all the women want to sleep with him when they don't, and it's kind of sad, right?
Sounds like me on the drops. Sounds like me on the early years on the drops.
No.
Being inappropriate. You go back and listen to what I ranted. I used to talk, I used to say crazy things in the first few weeks on the drops. You can go back in the spring of 2011 would be. I was talking about running around, screwing my neighbors, going on a rampage in the morning. You probably haven't heard those, but I was saying stuff like that.
No, but you did post before Bob Fest on my most conservative friend's Facebook about your... Remember that?
Yes.
It's not a used to, Bob.
Oh, yeah. I'm still inappropriate, yes.
To, right.
Yeah.
Me and all my conservative women friends talking about yoga, and you're like, this weekend on Bob Fest.
I did that on Sue Bones Facebook a couple of times too. So, okay, so this guy, though, I'm saying this was normal in the 70s and 80s, this coke addiction, which would be the electric digital transition to the Android meme is making everybody want to be keep up with it. So John Belushi, everybody goes on coke and are speeding for many years. He is not unusual at this point in his story. Everybody did. They didn't understand why they felt empty.
But there's something really, really sad about seeing someone, because John Belushi is just a funny guy, and he's in the comic role, so that was kind of all okay. There's something very sad about somebody who wrote Rainy Days and Mondays and was only just begun to live sex appeal and knows it and is heartbroken about that. Like, he's clearly tortured. So
he's in it for the sex? Is that what his issue is? He's in it for sex and it's not working?
I mean, I think partially. I don't know what he was in it for. I'm just saying that there's something like really, really tragic, but it's not tragic comedy.
That is pretty tragic. He couldn't even get groupies, even though he was famous.
Right.
He couldn't, because he was not physically attractive.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
I mean, when
I mentioned to you, when
I was going to talk about him, when we talked earlier in the week, you were like, oh, yeah, I remember him, that little short guy with the bangs. I mean, like,
he did have an unappealing, that's right, he had an unappealing.
Very unappealing.
So, right, he just
was. Well, he was cute. And
he wasn't even cute, he was silly cute.
No,
he was,
correct.
He was ugly cute. He had glasses, didn't he? Didn't he wear glasses, too?
Yes, he wore glasses. And if you
yeah,
see
I,
him, like,
I thought that. You know, I thought he was a payola guy. I wasn't going to look into him because I didn't like his music, but I figured this guy was propped up by some investors. I had no clue that he had talent, but I figured this guy's so ridiculous. This is the payola kind of star. But no, I was wrong.
No,
but he was looked at as a payola guy.
But you know what they're saying on the biographies now is he's marrying some girl who could be his granddaughter. So at age 74, he's finally found his girlfriend.
So how do you know this? When did you just look it up?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So so now he's got a scandal for who
he is. He ran off with a girl. He was married to his first wife, and then he ran off with a younger girl to whom he's still married. Mm-hmm. And he's been sober since, like, 19.
When did he run off? This is with the young girl that Carol's talking about, he ran off with?
Yeah,
like when,
I don't know what Carolyn's looking at, but he's been with his second wife for a while. Oh, no, Tracy is his co-author on the book.
Yeah,
Tracy
so what?
Well, it made me think on the Google that he was marrying this Tracy girl.
Who's a young girl.
No, that's the person that he wrote the book with.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So the thing is, he is married in the 70s and 80s, and he's looking to have all kinds of sex. Is his wife not aware of that? Or has he left his wife in the 70s and 80s?
He left his wife for a younger girl in the 70s and 80s. But even before he left his wife, when he would go on television appearances, I saw him, he would make really inappropriate jokes. Like, I'm a good wife and father until I get alone on the road. And then I'm fucking anything that moves. Like, he wouldn't say that, but that was the whole vibe.
Yeah.
But
none
of that was really happening, which is what made it so sad. So you're going on TV, you're talking about being a womanizer, you're talking about cheating on your wife on the Johnny Carson show and making a joke about it and standing up and grinding your hips like you're Elvis.
Wow.
And everybody's probably laughing at you because no one wants to have sex with you.
But people didn't know that. People didn't know that he wasn't getting any, you know, because they assumed he was.
I think they kind of did, because it just, even when I was watching it, I felt uncomfortable. And I would be like, and I knew the whole story, so I'm sure I was biased. But I would be like, yeah, right, sure. You know,
I remember seeing him on TV once in that period when he was famous and immediately thinking this is not worth paying attention to. So I must have picked up on his pain or his inappropriateness. You know, he just seems silly.
Right.
So what is he writing now about then? What does he say about the way he was? Okay.
Oh, he's embarrassed. Right. He can't stand it. So here's what happened. So he got sober and he disappeared from Hollywood and wherever else he would make music at that time. And he has fans in, like, the Philippines and some odd, weird places. You know how often our pop stars will become popular in other countries years later, like David Hasselhoff was really big in Germany, et cetera, et cetera. So he had enough of that sort of work to sustain him, but his tours, in the documentary they showed him, weren't even as nice as my niece's tours. So he's really, like, he's pretty much lost everything, but has enough money to live. And what else is he supposed to do? It's not like he's going to go get an office job. But to go from Oscar, Grammy, 49 appearances on Johnny Carson, to everybody pretty much thinking you're dead and your audience is in the Philippines, he's
and
a
you're saying,
okay?
You're saying his music wasn't as good as your niece's. You mean when he did play in the...
No. The quality of his tours. His tours.
What, you mean the quality of his performance?
No, the venue.
Oh, he wouldn't get any clubs.
Right.
So he couldn't even get clubs.
He went to countries where they have short people.
Carol, the king of the midgets.
So he's
he knows that world.
He's performing at like the Holiday Inn in the Philippines.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty bad, eh?
It is bad. But he's sober at this point. So he's sustaining his life and he's sober. Okay, and then suddenly, a couple weeks ago, he's on Oprah Super Soul Sunday. I'm folding laundry. I turn on it was an impressive synchronicity how I found the book too. Like, one of my friends posted something on Facebook. I thought it was interesting. I liked it. It was a quote from Paul Williams. I was like, wow, Linda, that's a really great quote. I go in the bedroom to turn on the television to fold laundry, and there he is on Super Soul Sunday. And at first I was really disgusted by him, but then as I learned more about him, I ended up, I kind of adore him. And it really, all of this looking at his work had a huge impact on me, which we can talk about if we want to, but I don't want to talk about myself necessarily, so we could do that very, very, very last. But I was grossed out.
So on Oprah, he actually does a successful Oprah show. People like
emerging,
him.
He's emerging as the next recovery guru. And Oprah has completely supported him. And he wrote a book with this Tracy Jackson. She's a semi-successful screenwriter. The only movie that I know that she wrote is called Confessions of a Shopaholic. And it's not Citizen Kane, believe me. I mean, I'm sure she did decent at the box office. But so we've got a has-been artist, and we've got someone who never really made it. These two people come together. Paul's a certified drug and alcohol counselor now. And, like, I'm just going to mention this, and if we have time to talk about it later, I would love to talk about alcohol as a media, and what is that an extension of? And why did humans create alcohol? And then, like, what does that do? And then, in addition, if we look at total biology of alcoholism as a disease, what is that disease trying to manage for a person if they create alcoholism for themselves? And when Paul talks about recovery, which is what his book is about, he doesn't get into the cocaine as much as he gets into the alcohol. So though he did the coke, as you mentioned, John Belushi and all the other people who did Richard Pryor and blah, 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 who all did all the cocaine, his drug of choice, the one that he chose to go into recovery for, is alcohol. Because he didn't go to Narcotics Anonymous. He went to Alcoholics Anonymous, AA. Mm. So he meets up with this Tracy Jackson. And they're in Hollywood where almost everybody is in recovery for something. Everybody's going to 12-step meetings. And he's a certified drug and alcohol counselor. And Tracy is jealous of people who are in recovery because she thinks that it's wonderful that they have these 12 steps, these 12 principles that they can return to again and again and again to help them guide their life. So another offshoot of this conversation, if we have time for me, would be, what is the 12 steps as a media? What is that an extension of? And on and on down the rabbit hole on that. So they get together.
Is she an alcoholic too? Is she an alcoholic?
No. But her point is, why do you have to be an addict to use the 12 steps? Let's get together, me and you, Paul, and we're going to write a book called Gratitude and Trust, Six Affirmations That Will Change Your Life. And it's kind of AA light. It's for people who might use but aren't straight-up addicts. It's for people who abuse but haven't hit a bottom, or people who aren't addicts but instead of having life-threatening behaviors surrounding a substance abuse issue, they have life-limiting behaviors around choosing the wrong man, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting to get different results, having bad habits, overspending, overeating. So, like, not an obese person who needs Overeaters Anonymous, but someone who can't lose 10 pounds that would make them fulfill their potential and have, like, their best body. So they get together.
And wait, I have a point to make here. Is Tracy's also pissed that she's not in these programs because that's the social life? That's how you meet people in recovery programs in Hollywood?
I think so.
Yeah, that's how you network, eh?
I also think that the has-been and the didn't quite have the level of success that she wanted got together and thought, if we can write a book and we can get on Oprah, then you're not a has-been anymore, and I can finally make it because we're going to get Oprah's blessing.
Yeah.
So, in fact, let me go now to this blog that he wrote.
Well, before you do that, I want to ask a bit about Oprah. Why did you fall in love with him on Oprah? What did Oprah do with him?
I didn't on Oprah. After I saw him on Oprah, I was so disgusted I had to keep leaving the room. In fact, I had to return after I had done some further research and watched the Oprah Super Soul Sunday. I was so grossed out by him and so grossed out by Oprah. The reasons I always get grossed out by Oprah, just the smugness and the, like, I'm going to tell, like, now you're going to make it because I'm going to tell you that you're okay. Like, you're not God. No. But if I tell you that that you have my backing, your book's going to be number one tomorrow, and I fully support you, and now you've made it, you know, and that just was grossing me out.
That's Oprah's attitude. That's Oprah's meme.
Oh, my God.
You're talking about Oprah's meme. Yeah.
Oprah's meme. And that's okay. Yeah. She's doing the best she can. I just had to leave the room a couple of times.
Right. Yes, Dianette would not be able to handle that. Even a post-Dianette couldn't take it.
Couldn't take what?
Oprah, you, as a post-Dianette, couldn't take it. I say Dianettes would not like Oprah. Yeah, you as a post-Dianette did not like what you were hearing or the environment that Oprah was creating.
No, but I still look at it all the time because I want to know what's going on in pop culture. Okay, so then I'm going to read this blog now because this is more of what grossed me out.
Right. This is his blog.
After all. His blog. So after he's on emotions on Oprah, he writes this thing called the bucket list on his blog, and he's talking about how excited he is to be on Oprah, and he says his bucket list. Mine has always been minimal. Life came at me generous with opportunities few people enjoy. I've met presidents, iconic talents in every field, and the top of the A-list. I once dined with Cary Grant, have a snug medley with Fred Astaire and Tony Bennett, sip Jack Daniels with Sinatra. Okay, the truth, I never really sipped anything. Good fortune took me places I'd only dreamed of. The run of the litter, the escapee from a 24-foot trailer, had been treated like a king. My gratitude cup runneth over. In fact, it's beginning to look like a water bucket scene from Disney's The Sorcerer's Apprentice. September 16th, the day the book was published. And that's another thing. Listen, he calls it the book. Did you ever see the movie What About Bob?
Yes. I saw that one.
Okay. So you know the doctor in that movie. Who plays that? I can't remember. It's Bill Murray and it's whoever.
What'd you say, Carol?
His name is escaping me.
Oh, no, he's talking about she said the doctor, not Bob. That's Bill Murray.
Who's the psychiatrist?
I haven't seen that in a long time.
It'll come to me. But
what about him?
He's all excited because he's publishing his book, the book. People come out of the woodwork when you write a book. So he's my point.
Yeah, but what's the psychiatrist got to do with it? Okay, Paul's publishing his book.
It reminds me of that movie. Yeah, it reminds me of that movie, how he's just so excited with himself because he's got the book. September 16th, the day the book was published.
Right, and that happens in What About Bob?
Yeah, and
Yes. I shouldn't have brought that up. Never mind.
Richard Dreyfuss.
Richard Dreyfuss.
And what does the psychiatrist do in What About Bob?
He just goes crazy because he's written a book. He's so impressed with himself and excited that because he's written a book, and then Bob spoils it all for him.
Oh, Dreyfuss wrote the book?
Yes. Dreyfuss wrote a book. Yes. Bob, get off.
As a character. And Bill Murray ruins it.
Yes. But I shouldn't have brought that up because now you're thinking on it. Move on. Let's move on. Okay, September 16th, the day the book was published, we flew to Chicago to tape Super Soul Sunday. Truly a bucket list event.
Karen was on mute and didn't know it. What did you say, Karen? Richard, I got to get the Dreyfuss thing.
Yeah, but I want to know.
Oh, my God.
In the movie, Richard Dreyfuss, is a psychiatrist, wrote a book. Bill Murray, the totally messed up mental patient, reads a book, seeks out Dreyfuss because he thinks he can fix him, and just totally stalks him for the whole movie.
Okay, and what is this? Is Dreyfuss ruined in that way? What's the problem?
Yes, he is totally ruined in that way.
By Bill Murray. Okay, so
by
now
Bill Murray.
You have. So now, how does this relate to Paul Williams? What happens in this case? What are we saying?
We're making way too big of a deal of the reference. I never should have brought it up. The only thing
it doesn't even apply, Katie. Come on, what did apply? Something must have applied.
Because he calls it the book. That's my point.
Okay.
Paul Williams has done everything that I read to you. That I didn't even read the whole thing because I didn't want to take up all our time reading that.
No. Read what you were reading.
Fabulous Life.
Okay, let's hear some of the blog that we didn't hear. Start over again. What does the blog say about the book?
My point, Bob, listen, don't interrupt for 1 second, is that he's calling it the book. Every other accomplishment that he's ever done in his whole life pales in comparison to the book.
Well, that proves my
point.
That's the American archetype.
Right.
That's what he's arrived at, the real valuable world, the world of the Bible and the book.
All right. So then he talks about going into the green room and seeing Oprah and how fabulous she is and this and that and the other thing. And
well, I'd like to hear how he writes about that. Let's hear.
You want to hear it? Okay, I'll read it.
Yeah.
I'd love to read it. Okay.
Yeah.
Let me start in the middle. There's nothing like that moment when she walks into the green room, arms wide open like you're her best friend, with three octaves. Hello! Do you know that how Oprah says that? Hello! Makes you feel like she's been waiting for you all her life.
It's like Ginny. Ginny does Oprah, I think. Isn't Ginny like Oprah, Carol? The way she greets people? Hello! Yeah, I think there's a bit of Oprah in Ginny. Okay, that's a relevant sidebar. Okay, let's see if Ginny is listening. I'll just check the list here. Is she on here?
No, she's out of town. You said she was out of town.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
right,
there
right.
So,
yeah.
No, she's not here.
Okay,
back to you.
Okay.
So he said, that's a good description. That's fun. Okay, so she comes in and says hello.
The thing that made me sick about this is just he's like cranking up the pedestal. Okay, he's cranking it up. Let me go on. Gulp. It's so powerful you don't really notice the film crew you've been prepped to see following her. In fact, you've been seated in positions that will be camera visible as she swoops through the door.
Hey, you know what? Your phone's a little off. I'm missing words.
Oh, crap.
Are you speaking too close, or are you in a wrong kind of phone? What is your phone? It's not perfect quality.
iPhone.
So just maybe don't have your mouth as close to it, because we're missing words.
Okay.
So he goes gulp. He writes gulp when he sees her.
Yep.
Then what happens after that?
Gulp.
Maybe read a little slower.
Okay, I'll read slower. Gulp. It's so powerful you don't really notice the film crew you've been prepped to see following her. In fact, you've been seated in positions that will be camera visible as she swoops through the door.
No, I didn't get that. You've been seated. He's talking about in the green room. He's been seated in the green room to be invisible, or what? What is it you're saying?
No, he's just saying that he's been. Well, I'll just read it again.
Yeah.
You've you've been seated in positions that will be camera visible as she swoops through the door. In other words, the cameras are on him because the film crew wants to be able to capture his reaction when he sees the great and
powerful.
He's
calling that camera visible.
Correct.
That means the cameras are visible to him.
No, he's visible to the camera so they can film him have a cow when he sees
her. So is he seated in the green room for that effect? He's seated in the green room to be visible for the cameras to pick him up immediately as soon as she walks in.
Because that's the way Oprah always does her show. You can see the prep. You can see the interview questions. Sometimes they film her interviewing you and or whoever the guest is. Like, she uses a lot of weird camera angles, so you feel like you're backstage. It's
now,
not
this
like
is done before you get on the camp, before you get on live?
Yeah. So on Super Soul Sunday, you get to see a lot of the background, too.
So they're showing you the background, preliminary talkings by Paul, and the camera's showing him as he's getting ready to be live.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Now, he's going to refer in an upcoming paragraph to a woman called T-E-E. That's his nickname for Tracy because her name starts with a T. So when you hear that, he's talking about Tracy, okay? She snags you by the arm like Dorothy grabbing the Tin Man, reaches over and snags T, and suddenly we're off to meet the wizard. Wizardess?
What does she do to T?
She snags T.
Yeah.
So Oprah comes in, takes him by the arm, and then takes T, and suddenly we're off to meet the wizard. Wizardess? Okay?
Yeah.
And as we make our way to the lighted set at the end of the dark hallway, she leans over and softly says, "No, it's a gift." I think she might have laughed, and I get the message. It's a dose of comfort. She's letting me know she gets us. She's read the book and found truth worth sharing with her audience.
That's what he's thinking. She's not saying anything.
So
she's not saying that to
over,
him.
She leaned over to him and said, "It's a gift." Oprah did say that. So he's describing how.
If that was me, I'd say it. We've had many topics already in the first 30 seconds. What is your it referring to, Oprah, is what I would have said. What's a gift?
Right.
I'm a gift to the masses, as the psychic told me in May 1971. Bertie Ketchy told me I was that 40 years ago. So I would have said that to Oprah. Are you quoting? How did you know Bertie Ketchy said that about me? My interview with her is going to it'll break
right.
Everything.
Yeah, Kim Kardashian's butt broke the internet, and your interview is
my mouth will break everything. Okay, so she says it's a gift, and he then is thinking, he says thoughts about that?
Yes, because when she says it's a gift, Bob, she's referring to his book. So he's just basking. He's just having a Mark D. 16 ejaculation over the fact that Oprah.
That's a good one,
book.
Mark D. 16 ejaculation. Mark, you're becoming famous. You're becoming an archetype.
Okay. All right, so
okay.
Here we go. That would be everyone. Hey, this is Vector's block. That would be everyone. Okay, I just slipped into Weepy Williams mode. Just got that wave of gratitude that your soul answers with salty tears. That lump in the throat you can't quite talk through. My minister, Jim Terrell, calls it God's punctuation. I love that. That's him saying I love that. That's not me saying that.
What is he talking about? Is he still talking about the effect of being with Oprah in the corridor?
Yes. On the set. That's another on the set. On the set, we sit across from her and almost don't notice when the circular floor begins to slowly rise, lifting us up to a better angle for the many cameras surrounding us. Lifting us to a height where the blue screens behind us can best frame our faces. Better, I suppose, if they should choose to flash images of the remarkable past that brought Tracy and I to this place.
Mm.
The lifting is a... It is, but it's still, it's like you would think that he would... I mean, if he's ascending, okay, let's talk about the lifting floor. But you're just on Oprah. You know what I mean? It's like, get a grip on yourself, Paul.
But he is describing. I don't know if anybody described the mechanics of it like he has.
No.
That's pretty good description.
I love him. He's a good writer. I love the book. I love him. But I'm still going to laugh at this.
Yeah.
The lifting is a perfect metaphor for what she's doing, what she's always done, raised our consciousness to a higher level, lift us with her generosity of spirit and passionate conversation with the most remarkable alumni ever assembled. Tracy D. Jackson is a member of that esteemed group now. So is Paul Hamilton Williams.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. That's the Kmart Cheese Whiz mainstream nothing world that he's describing. So he doesn't need. There's no Paul Williams there. That's just what you're supposed to write. If you actually had to write and describe a praise of Oprah, you would say stuff like that, which is very bad stuff.
No, I think evil. I think he means this, Bob. I think he thinks that.
Well, that's because
he's
all made up of those ideas. This is verbality. This is the android meme speaking, not Paul, not the little guy that grew up and went to high school. This is the android meme of his brain speaking the android meme cliches. And
right.
He doesn't even know
right.
that he didn't even write this. He doesn't
right.
even know there's nobody
okay.
there to write it anymore.
Okay,
so that's
he,
good.
Now
that's
he,
a good good bullshit fucking crap replay of the archetype of Oprah's meme. I mean, boy, he hasn't got an original thought in his head.
Okay, let me read on. Now he writes a little, he writes a little, okay, so I need a hanky. I thought this was a letter to Oprah. I guess it kind of is. I need a hanky, Oprah. Dear Oprah, can you guess what it feels like to sit across from you and have you celebrate recovery? Can you imagine the grace of that moment for me, for all of us who've been granted this sweet reunion with spirit, with our higher powers, our families, and our passion to do something meaningful and good, to be honored by your approval? Oh, my God.
Hey, listen, Katie, Oprah walks by our house all the time when she got her time off. I'm hoping she's walking by while I'm here blasting her in the next few minutes, or maybe it already happened 2 minutes ago. So everybody note that Oprah's within hearing me. She just lives up the street from us, and she walks through here casually, kind of anonymously. Everybody knows, but they don't bother her. And she walks right by here, and if this is booming enough, she should hear it, because if you can go that way, she could hear it. So I'm hoping she's hearing me declare her evil. This is what we hope. This is evil.
Are you going to declare her evil?
I already did about 2 minutes ago. I said, that's evil, what's happening to Paul, what Paul is expressing. I mean, it's the ultimate of, as I said in the latest Roxy video, the ascending are descending, and the descending are ascending. This guy is descending via the cliches of erroneous ascending.
Right.
This is sad. He's actually in big trouble. We need to put him back in the asylum the way he's acting here.
Yeah, nobody can recover unless Oprah says they can.
And they recover within the world of sentimental crap.
No, they recover commercially.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Now he's going to be a millionaire.
Yeah, you recover commercially.
Right.
Well, that's because they don't exist. Yeah. You know what wealth means, Carol, in America? You have access to the Android Memes facilities, that's all. You have cabs, and you get to go to concerts and everything that's expensive. That's all wealth is for, access to the multimedia software communist world we live in. Okay, back to you, Katie. Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Next line or whatever.
Okay, so to be honored by your approval. Thank you.
Right now your phone's clear. What did you do different? Did you fix your phone in some way? What did you do?
I just insisted that it be clear in my world.
Okay. Now talk a little slowly, but read some more.
Thank you, Oprah. Thank you for giving voice to the principles of the recovery movement. Thank you for endorsing the philosophy of two totally non-professionals who scooped up hunks of their own history, the good and the bad, and forged a simple plan to share what we knew would work if one was willing to change. We believe that what we have to offer will help people rise above the destructive habits that dent and sometimes destroy their lives. We will be heard now. You did that. Thank you, Oprah.
Boy, that's,
Tracy,
that's great. Oh, go ahead.
I know. Well, and before I read on, and I will read on, but in another blog that I didn't print out, I thought it was in this one. I told you this when we talked last week, but he got to have his book launch at Shakespeare and Company.
Oh, yeah.
And in one of his blogs, he wrote, "And I can't believe that here I am reading my book at Shakespeare and Company where Joyce read his books." And I don't mean Joyce DeWitt. Do you know who Joyce DeWitt is from Three's Company?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he's like, he's saying here,
I'm equal to James Joyce, who wrote a book. First of all, Shakespeare and Company closed down in 1941 when Sylvia Beach stood up to the Nazis. I don't know what they got going there now.
It's one of her nieces or some descendant of Sylvia Beach. That has the store still open.
All right.
And the other thing that I find ironic is, like, Paul Williams, I know there's no poets anymore, I know that, but his lyrics are beautiful. Like, if he was reading some of the songs there, okay, that'd be cool, but you're reading A.A. Light at Shakespeare and Company and having a Mark D. 16 ejaculation and comparing yourself to James?
This is serious media confusion.
serious confusion.
Yeah, what we see here is this guy never did recover from his youth. He blew it when he was famous. He blew it when he was unpopular, and he's blowing this even more. And he's claiming this erroneous evil book is going to help people. He is so mistaken that he didn't recover. This is what the thing proves. The way he's not aware of what we're doing. He's not in the leading edge. He's 40 years back there with the I'm okay, you're okay transactional analysis stuff or something. And it is actually sick that Oprah promotes his stuff, you know, that she has no idea the backwardness she lives.
Well, in the book, I'll finish reading this, but brief, just to what he did with this Tracy Jackson is they went back to the founders of AA, not Bill W., but it was some group, I could look for it, it doesn't matter, but it was some group of Christian people who had some founding tenets before the 12 steps were developed and looked at that core material, which basically just said that a belief in God can help you put down the bottle. And so instead of having 12 steps, they have 6 affirmations. So the book is based on the 6 affirmations, which are something needs to change, and it's probably me. I don't know how to do this, but something inside me does. I will learn from my mistakes and not defend them. I will make right the wrongs I've done whenever possible. I will examine my behavior on a daily basis. I will live in love and service, gratitude and trust. So they, like, on purpose went to try to develop a program and bring it to the marketplace. They did it
It's kindergarten talk. What a teacher would help her grade one people who failed grade one and have to do summer school, what they would write for their summer school experience. That is so childish, but McLuhan predicted that everybody would be the emotional. That's what Oprah's about, the completion of the idea that you can't be emotionally more mature than a three-year-old. That's what McLuhan predicted for the global nursery. Went from the global village to the global nursery. That's what Oprah's doing, talking to the children. And this book's for children. I mean, what is the aphorisms are...
affirmations.
No, I'm calling them aphorisms because that's the hidden grammatical. That's the technique that made McLuhan popular. We are an aphoristic society, not a prose society, P-R-O-S-E. And the aphorisms are aphorisms. Affirmations are aphorisms. And these are pretty bad aphorisms. But they say, I will pretend that I'm better, though. No, I won't think about it too much, and I hope somebody will help me. Well, was that the first one?
No, but Bob, an aphorism is, they say it's an original thought spoken or written in concise and memorable form. This is not original thought. It is not an aphorism.
No.
No, It's an original thought that Oprah makes billions out of this sentimentality and riding on an archetype. That's an original experience. So Oprah is an original in finding out how to replay America's past to the to Americans.
See what a wordsmith he is, Katie?
Yes, I can find meaning everywhere.
Yeah.
I find meaning right in evil patterns.
And that one didn't work, though.
No, it's a key point. It's one of the most important points I understand.
No.
Wealth is built on stupidity. You have to find a way to replay something in the past that means something to people and for their memory, for when they were a person, in some way. That's how you make millions. That's what you market.
Yeah, but you can't use aphorisms. There, that's all.
No, that definition of aphorism is wrong, Carolyn.
McLuhan wrote an aphorism.
Yeah, they don't have to be original. Aphorisms become collective wisdom, Carolyn. They're cliches. They can become cliches. Now, what Joyce did, he would take the cliche aphorisms and reflip them, make them say them backwards, and create a different kind of...
Okay, here's a better definition then. A pithy observation that contains a general truth.
Yeah, that's an aphorism.
Yeah,
and then Joyce, he improvised. The Finney's Wake is littered with original, crazy, backwards aphorisms.
Mm-hmm.
Like the West shall shake the East awake, and ye shall have the night for morn. Now you say that to your brother, Katie, or your mother, and she won't know what you're talking about. So it's not a normal, understandable aphorism, but it is an aphorism. The West shall shake the East awake, and ye shall. So Oprah, I get on Oprah. Bop. How did you come up with this crazy ISEL thing that makes no sense? Well, Oprah, the West shall shake the East awake, and ye shall have the night for morn.
Mm-hmm. She'll switch to a commercial.
Well, I was going to say, we'll stop. We'll stop the tape. We're going to redo this, start over again, yes. But no, that's what, you say something like that, it would be fun. Can you imagine her trying to come up with some witty response to that? She says, well, the night for morn. Well, I didn't sleep last night, Bob. I was so nervous to meet you. The night for morn, that's what I had. And I said, well, this has happened globally. Well, it happened 40 years ago globally. And the West became East, and the Chinese became Western. She'd go... She'd look off into space, go, interesting. And then she'd get refocused and go to the next question. Anyways, that's an aphorism. The West shall shake the East awake, and ye shall have the night for morn. It's a great line by Joyce. Television kills telephone. Yeah, the next line, she's asked me, you have quite a charming wife. How did you meet her? I'd say, television kills telephony and brothers broil.
Mm-hmm.
I turned into Being There. Remember that Chauncey Gardner who did Being There? And he just said these aphorisms and he became famous in that movie in the late 60s? Being There. Okay, sorry about talking about me. Back to
this
terrible excuse for a TV landscape called Paul Williams.
What I'd like to do is just read the last paragraph of this blog.
Okay.
And then I would like to talk about some of those other things that I brought up. That what are all these... Because this isn't Oprah. This is all just a product of something extended. This is all media massage.
Yes, so we
can't get mad at the people. So let's apply some mediological themes to these points that I brought up after I read this last paragraph.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So he goes on and on about how fabulous it was to be on Oprah, and then this is the closing paragraph. It's a day I'll never forget and an experience I can't quite remember. The music was too loud to hear the words. I heard Tracy saying things she's never said before.
Okay,
that was
I get distracted. I need to
start
the
over.
Again. Yeah. Can start again, please? What's
are you going to tell us what distracted you? You want to tell me what distracted you?
No, I can't. That's top secret. There's things going on here. I can't reveal.
All right. It's fine. It's a day I'll never forget. And an experience I can't quite remember. The music was too loud to hear the words. I heard Tracy saying things she'd never said before that were bumper sticker brilliant. Faith is a firewall to fear. I think that's one of the beauties first uttered in the company of Miss Winfrey.
Wait, what's this? What is that? The aphorism? What was the aphorism?
Faith is a firewall to fear.
Faith, F-A-I-T-H?
Correct.
Okay, faith is a firewall to fear. And that's what Tracy said.
Tracy said that, and then Paul
yeah.
says, I think that's one of the beauties first uttered in the company of Ms. Winfrey. Something clicked for both of us, and I think we spoke from the place most appreciated in Oprah's world, from our own authentic selves. In the end, she held our baby up to the camera and said we had a bestseller, or that it would change the world. I do remember her saying that it was perfect for Christmas or a Hanukkah gift. When I drank, I had blackouts. On Super Bowl Sunday, I had a whiteout. This book was Tracy's idea. I believe it's the most important work either of us have done, a chance to prove that recovery is not just for addicts. From the first days of writing, we allowed ourselves to dream big, then did the work. I highly recommend that combination. Dream away, child. Let your dreams run wild. They may come true if you season them with gratitude and trust. Then he says, hey, T, we're on Oprah. And that's the end.
What did he say? Hey, T, we're on Oprah?
Yeah, T, his co-author.
Hey,
like, hey,
yeah,
T.
Hey, T,
we're on.
We've been on.
No, we're on Oprah.
Right. I can't even understand
yeah.
His words. I don't even know what he's talking about. But it is actually, so Oprah is the problem here. Oprah is actually nuts. You know, people didn't know that Hitler was nuts when he was charismatic. And then that's the radio world, a hot medium. A cool medium has a new version of Hitler, but it's backwards. It's this emoting, sentimental, literate, fragmented scenario that McLuhan diagnosed in his February 1967 McLean's Magazine interview on love. And he explained the fragmented nature of love among literate people. Oprah is like a no wonder Ion hates Oprah. The stupidity of her hypnotism is equal to any charismatic guy that ever happened before, and it's representing a hidden ground that people don't know.
Well, didn't she
yeah,
promise
Bob, what
she was going off the air?
Her,
what? What, Katie?
Well, what did Carolyn say? Carolyn, did you say she was going off the air?
Yeah, didn't she promise us that she was going off the air?
She did in 2011.
No, she created her own network. So now this show, Super Soul Sunday, is on the OWN network, O-W-N, Oprah Winfrey Network. So she has her own channel
now. So
she
only does one show a week then?
No, she has all kinds of shows.
That
and
she
Super
does?
Soul
No. Does she perform daily and keep the grind going?
In some ways, yes, but sometimes her show will be like, whatever happened to past guests, and she'll do part of it, and then she'll send a team to go and collect some of the other pieces. So the answer to your question is no, but the reason she does, the answer to your question is yes, in the sense that she's now programming. So it's not just a show. She's programming a network, you know, like that show Network, that movie Network. She's in charge of
yeah.
all the programming. So it's not just a show now, it's a whole channel. And the pinnacle, the flagship piece of that network is the Super Soul Sunday show. So before, she had her show, and then that evolved into, then she had her book club. And so the book club, she was in charge of literacy. Now, she was telling everybody what to read, and she was in charge of whatever was going to be determined to be a bestseller. If you were an author and you got in part of the Oprah Winfrey Book Club, that is, you've made it.
Well, I know
now
that.
It's Super
yeah.
Soul, but now it's Super Soul Sunday. So if you're an emerging guru, Adya Shante was just on there recently. Marianne was on a couple weeks ago talking about how she felt about losing her Senate seat race. Paul was on.
Okay, so
next
Karen, we will not go on.
we will not go on.
Yeah, she invited us on. I'd say, no, Oprah, you come over here, and you're going to be massaged by the anti-environment to you. And if you don't want to do it, that's fine with us. We do not require your show. It's actually a mistake to go on your show.
I think you could go on Charlie Rose, though.
No. Well, if you did, I'd go on with you, yeah. Yeah, maybe Charlie
yeah,
Rose.
Yeah, so I want to go on Charlie Rose with you. I don't know what I would go on for now, since
Hey, we can't go on because you threw out the book and the TV show. I mean,
well,
what's going on?
You know I'll pick that back up. Shh, don't tell anyone.
Oh, okay. Okay, good.
Shh, don't tell anyone.
Something to live for. So, but the
I'm just not going to let someone in Hollywood tell me I have to change it. That's all.